Okay, welcome back. So the next couple of slides, we will get some more feel for what this two self energy expansion looks like. When you turn off the sources and so forth and do Fourier transforms, the propagator in Matsubara frequency space has a behavior like this. So this is like a non-interacting propagator inverse. So this itself is the auxiliary Green's function. And this factor is from the caparison factor. And you can rewrite this, if you wish, as g is the product of mu times a little g. And we can pursue these calculation of these two self energies in several different ways. One of the techniques would be an expansion in this parameter lambda that I talked about a minute ago. Like in the Dyson-Mallier problem, there is a 1 over 2s, and unknowingly, and just from mathematical considerations, I had introduced a parameter lambda in the Dyson series, and they turn out to map exactly into each other. And you can expand in lambda. That's one thing we can do, and we will do that to some extent. And then there is this low frequency expansion, which I said is prodded by Antoine, and it came out in connection with comparison with DMFT. And it actually gives us a very clear insight into what's new about this particular functional form, and what new physics can come out of this. That's right. So little g is the correlator of the CC dagger without the hats, with everything else in place.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is this related to the Couture approximation somehow, this g? No.
Actually, the Goodswiller approximation, I think, as I understand the name, it goes back to a statistical approximation to a wave function. And that's really very far from what we're doing here. We're actually doing dynamics. We're doing the exact dynamics. And we're using Goodswiller only to the extent of the projection operator. So Goodswiller projection operator filters out double occupancy. Other than that, it does nothing else. So it's an exact statement of removal of double occupancy. The Goodswiller approximation, you know, is very nice, and it played an important role in the early days. But it could only give us some statistical information about wave functions and things which are, in a way, accessible through other techniques nowadays. I mean, you can do Goodswiller projected wave functions. You can exactly compute expectation values through Monte Carlo and so forth. So in a way, this is very far from that version of Goodswiller. So in high dimensions, we can So in high dimensions, there is something else which happens. This psi and phi are both functions of momentum k. But they are functions of momentum k in such a way that they conspire to give you a Dyson self-energy, which is k-independent. And that matches the large D results of DMFT. And you can express that in the following way. This psi turns out to be k-independent, and phi turns out to be a sum of two k-independent functions multiplied by the dispersion epsilon of k. And this is a very delicate construction, and it guarantees that the reconstructed Dyson or Dyson-Mori self-energy is momentum-independent. And we have a proof that this is so, and this proof is independent of Wick's theorem and gives us momentum independence of the Hubbard model, which is so foundational to DMFT. And since we have this independent proof of K independence of the self-energy, of the Dyson self-energy, this tells you that the limit of large dimensions and the limit of large U can be taken in arbitrary order, because the old proof that we have in literature is from keeping U finite and let the dimensions become very large. And then, of course, the self energy is k independent. And you could push that and take the high U limit of that. And we are saying that you get the same answer by first setting U off to infinity, starting with the TJ model, and looking at the large dimensional limit of the TJ model. So just to remind you, this reconstruction happens through plugging in psi and phi here and inverting g to discover sigma. So a little algebra tells you that the Dyson-Mori self-energy is obtained from psi and chi by this relation. And this is explicitly k-independent. And in this we have also shown that there's a mapping which is completely analogous to the Georges Cotillard mapping, where the Hubbard model was mapped to an Anderson impurity model with a self-consistent set of parameters. And the same thing happens here. For the TJ model, this maps on to an Anderson impurity model with infinite U and with well-chosen, suitably chosen parameters. So for example, this is the infinite dimensional TJ model with no J. So T hops in a certain way, T scales as 1 over square root of the dimension. And this maps onto the Anderson impurity problem with the hybridization is through the infinite U Fermi operators at the localized level. And this is the uncorrelated band, of course, epsilon K hat is the energy of the band electrons. And this has to be chosen in a particular self-consistent way, which is here. And incidentally, we also obtain an independent solution of the TJ model and also the Anderson impurity model as an expansion in lambda. In other words, we could go back and use the Anderson impurity model solution through NRG or whatever. That's one thing we can do. But alternately, we can have a direct solution of the TJ model using this lambda expansion. And these two comparisons can be made. And it looks really very interesting. We actually capture a lot of the correct shapes of spectral functions. So we'll see that later on. So we have not just a mapping, we also have a constructive solution to some order in lambda. And before getting too far, I should say that there is a very simple thing you can do. You can assume that psi and phi have a Fermi liquid structure. Okay? Now, why should you assume that? I mean, I have not given you any reason to assume that so far. But for a minute, bear with me. Give me that license. And I will demonstrate that in a few minutes using the lambda expansion. The lambda expansion really screams that psi and phi have the same bubble structure as in typical Fermi liquid. So they are really very much like Fermi liquid self-energies. But if you assume that and plug it into a low frequency expansion, which is what we did to compare with the DMFT, you get something which is very useful and tells you already what's happening with this new approach. So psi, apart from a constant, is expanded in omega and k, where this, okay, I should say that r here, the script r is omega squared plus t squared, which appears in Fermi liquids. So as you know, in a Fermi liquid, the self-energy has a linear term in omega, a linear term in wave vector k measured from the Fermi surface. So this is a scalar k hat. In normal direction to the Fermi surface. And this is imaginary. So there is an imaginary part, the decay of the Gaussian particles in Fermi liquids go like omega squared. And this omega, of course, gives you the wave function renormalization. So what you can assume is the structure with coefficients which you will suitably fit, or you can calculate them from first principles later on. So if you assume that, psi has an expansion, and phi has a very similar expansion, basically, apart from some trivial functions. This has a linear term in omega, a linear term in k, and a quadratic in omega with a pure imaginary term, up to order omega cubed. And alpha 0, this coefficient of the numerator, is argued to be, well, it's exactly 1 minus n by 2 plus sine 0. And we have very good arguments that this should go like 1 minus n, where n is the number of particles. So as you approach half filling, this should vanish. So if you assume this low frequency expansion, you get something very neat. You get a spectral function for this class of models where you have something which looks exactly like a Fermi liquid. So this gamma 0 is like omega squared plus t squared with a scale omega. So this is one of the five parameters in this thing. So this guy is exactly like a Fermi liquid. And v is a velocity, which basically is one of these coefficients. And mu is this capacitor function, which is multiplying a Fermi liquid. And this is a function of omega and k. And this is a linear function of omega and k. And this contains a dimensional parameter, delta 0, which is the emergent energy scale. Delta 0 turns out to become very small as you approach half filling. So this correction from this mu term becomes very, very large. So this gives you also asymmetry in the spectral functions. And a lot of the interesting fits to ARPES, at least in the proximity of the Fermi energy, simply follow from the fact that you have a linear correction to a Fermi liquid of a particular type. And this has experimental consequences. This can be, you know, checked against data. And further, there is a generalized Brinkman-Rice kind of scaling that you can easily show from this expansion. These parameters near half filling go linearly with delta, with some coefficient which are independent of the filling. So if you plug these in, then the spectral function at k and omega as a function of t and the whole filling scales out to give you something like omega delta 0 over delta and t delta 0 over delta times delta 0, where delta 0 is some fairly large whole filling. So what this is telling you is that the system in the close proximity of the half filling behaves like a system which is very far away, provided you scale the frequencies appropriately and also the temperature. And I'll come back and talk about the interesting physics which is contained in the scaling relation, which is just a consequence of this expansion. And indeed, at t equal to 0, this is exactly the Brinkman-Rice scaling that, many of you have perhaps seen. So next, I'm going to talk about somewhat involved things. The original way of the calculation went through the Schwinger technique. And this requires functional derivatives and functional integration. And it is pretty rough going if you are doing this for the first time. However, I recently discovered an alternate universe where the word functional integration has a completely different meaning. So this was in a university in Singapore that I visited, and these guys had a magazine where functional integration is defined as... Oh, this is falling flat. This is probably too American a humor. Functional integration in the business management world means something completely different. And when I saw that, I said, okay, it can't be very hard. I mean, I should be able to do functional integrals. So, all right. Okay. So the Schwinger method is, in brief, as follows. We're going to work with expectation values, which I'm going to denote by this double bracket. This means I take any object and take trace time ordered e to the minus action. And this action contains, in addition to the Hamiltonian, a bosonic source term. This is a time-dependent potential which couples to the density field, or the spin density, or the charge density field. And X is, as I said, are these non-canonical objects. And really, the only tool that we need, as Schwinger showed us, was the functional derivative of this Q with respect to this bosonic source generates higher order correlation functions. So that's really the whole idea of Schwinger, that the higher order correlation functions which you encounter in these equations of motion are generated by taking functional derivatives with respect to this extra potential. And this is just the disconnected part, and it's really just a exploitation of this almost elementary result that Schwinger did. Of course, the magic of Schwinger was in putting these together to create a whole sort of a tower of knowledge, right? And we're going to imitate what Schwinger did. We're going to take off and find some changes which are of help to us. So I'm going to use this notation where I stands for position and also time. And this is the object I'm trying to calculate. So, right, and you can do this after an afternoon of horrible headache. You can do this calculation of the equation for this propagator. And what you find is that it has three terms on the right. Well, this is the source term which comes from commuting with this A. This becomes a part of the effective Hamiltonian. So that gives us a source term. And finally, we're going to set the source to zero. And that's when you can do Fourier transforms. So this term is going to be killed after you take derivatives later on. And this coefficient of the delta function is where the non-trivial consequences of the X operators comes in. So with canonical electrons, CC dagger anti-commutator is 1. So you would get 1 here. But here, the anti-commutator of X and X dagger contains a density field here. So you get here a time-dependent Green's function. This gamma is, in fact, precisely a local Green's function. And that multiplies this delta function. And a lot of the complexity in this non-canonical theory arises from the presence of this gamma here. If this were not here, this would be just another straightforward problem. This makes all the difference because you're multiplying the most singular term in the differential equation by a time-dependent function. And X, I should define for you, X is a functional derivative operator which has a T part and a J part. And D here is a functional derivative with respect to this nu here. So you can see what this X is doing. X is simply generating all the required higher order propagators in this problem. The higher order Green's functions are being generated by this functional derivative. And you can sort of pack them into this neat notation. So this big X generates, when it's acting to the right, all the higher order derivatives. And here, this bold letter J is something that is being integrated out, summed over. So this is the notation is I and F are the initial and final space-time points. And this thing with the bar and bold letters is something being integrated out in between. And Y is something like a band structure. This is like a hopping. And there's a term here which involves the hopping multiplied by the local Green's function. So Y itself can be written as a sum of two parts. One part is just a bare band structure with just the T without the gammas. And then there's a part which goes as the product of these two things. So this is pretty straightforward to do. And in a way, so far, we have done nothing but brute force calculations. Now here, this is where you need to think about how to proceed with such a problem. Basically, the problem really is how to deal with this time-dependent function multiplying the delta function. And after some thought, and after following several false leads, which I'm too embarrassed to acknowledge, it struck me that really the neatest thing to do is a product ansatz. Think of G as a product of two functions of time, space and time, where B bar is being integrated out again. Now, the caparison function appeared here as an attempt to get rid of this gamma. And now that all of you have seen the Dyson-Maliev decomposition, you of course know that this kind of a product formalism product form is very natural. And indeed, post facto, it is extremely natural. But that's not how I went at it. My first attempt was really at trying to tame this highly singular term in this differential equation. And that led to this particular breakup. And I should say that this is a convolution in space and time. Therefore, in frequency space, it's a product. It's a product of two functions of omega. And this differs very much from what people were trying in the slave boson problem. In the slave boson representation, as you know, one thinks of the Green's function in real space as being a product in real space of a bosonic part and a fermionic part, so that in k omega space, it becomes a convolution. And then, of course, things become very different, and it becomes rather hard to get coherence unless you both condense and stuff like that. So in a way, this convolution in space-time and the product in omega space makes it much easier to get a coherent propagating piece, which is like a Fermi-liquid part in this problem.
Yeah.
Okay, in Dyson-Maliev, we did, okay, maybe I can just write here. See, in Dyson-Maliev, G was something like C, C dagger 1 minus N. So this was C, C dagger minus, right? So this guy is little g. And this guy is actually G times the self energy psi. I mean, apart from a connected part, I mean, you take a connected part, take some constant out. But basically, think of C, C dagger and sigma bar, the connected part, as a self energy times a G. In other words, the self energy is this thing divided by CC dagger. So you can translate this and write CC dagger and sigma bar as psi times little g. So this, of course, combines into little g times a constant minus psi. And this is exactly what this is. This mu is exactly this constant. Which one? Here?
CC dagger n.
Yeah.
You write like G times psi.
But that's how you define self energies in the Feynman theory. See, in the Feynman theory, if I ask you what is a self energy.
But usually you take the inverse of the Green's function, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have just taken the. I have taken that back, right? I mean, I've taken. This is how you define a self energy, apart from a U, I mean. Would you agree with this?
Well, I don't know, for me, a self energy is usually a difference between two inverse, right? Between inverse interacting in its function and bare interacting in its function.
No, but on the other hand, if you look at how one extracts a self energy in the Anderson imperial, this is the paper that you have written. Yes. This I actually got from your papers.
Yeah,
so from equations of motion, where you don't a priori know what the self energy is, this is the only way to define it. You take a four-order Green's function, divide that by this. So then, of course, this is exactly G times mu. And okay, for me, as I said, this is not the x operator. This is like a functional derivative operator. X is this x here. I'm sorry to have abused the notation. This x is not the Hubbard x operator. This is like a particular functional derivative operator. You see what I'm saying? This x is a function, is a functional derivative with respect to site I and with respect to site j times tij. And not to be confused, I apologize, but the labels are very different. It's got brackets which tell you the space-time arguments of x. This is very different from the x operators, which have got, you know, site index and spin. Yeah, yeah. Which is what this is. This is exactly that. X, because a functional derivative acting on G generates the higher order Green's functions. Yeah, but you can, the point is, what Schwinger showed is that the propagator satisfies a functional differential equation.
Yeah, but you have to stop somewhere.
Oh. You have to do something with it, of course. You have to do, you have to discover a handle which enables some calculation. You have to either have perturbation theory or non-perturbative techniques, or perhaps we've been discussing with Antoine the possibility of doing stochastic sums. Yeah, analytically, I'm going to do a lambda expansion, which I will show you in a few minutes. And I'll tell you exactly what I mean by that.
But one thing I want to comment on,
yes.
Besides the technical question of calculating something concrete with this, the formalism suggests a decomposition of the physical Green's function into something which is a very run-of-the-mill family quid, which is small g, with particular symmetry. Times a function which goes to one on the mass shell on the Fermi surface at zero frequency.
Yes.
But which is very quickly non-zero because it in particular asymmetric.
Yes.
So that it sort of decorates the Fermi liquids and make it look less and less as the Fermi liquid as you increase omega.
Exactly.
That's the intuition you have from the frequency expansion.
That's right.
So even without doing calculation, this already suggests sort of a hidden Fermi.
Yes.
And that's how it connects to the Anderson case.
That's right. Anderson, because we're talking about a hidden Fermi liquid, but you know, I should talk about the Anderson paper in the next lecture, but in a way, you're dealing with Phil Anderson. I mean, Phil's language is that of a convolution in space. And he talks about a hidden Fermi liquid. So Anderson also talks about a hidden Fermi liquid. And he multiplies that by X-ray edge singularity factor. And the whole thing is done in real space. But actually, when you look at the calculation, which is very skimpy, being Anderson, you see that, in fact, he's also doing a product in K-space. He's not really doing a convolution.
No, but I didn't mean to bring the Anderson paper on the table.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
For how an underlying Fermi liquid can be very quickly masked.
That's right.
As we go just away at small frequency.
Exactly.
We check together that this is very nicely in key line shapes as well.
Yes.
So the fixed point is still a Fermi liquid.
Indeed. Indeed. So, yeah. Oh, that's a very good point. And we'll talk about Anderson later on. But indeed, this is the heart of the whole thing in a way. And which is why I thought it was useful to see this product Ansatz from a different point of view in the beginning. And I think this questioning that you did was very useful. Actually, this is, I'm glad we repeated this. So this is really key point. And I will show you next that by using the chain rule for functional derivatives, we can actually get rid of this gamma, and we can find a little g satisfying a differential equation, which is almost exactly like this, without this gamma factor. And this gamma factor comes back in through the time-dependent mu term, which can be calculated self-consistently. It's a bit like, I mean, I think this has shades of the kinds of things we do with partial differential equations. But anyway, it's just as easy to talk about our physical problem, so I will do that. And I should say that this local Green's function, which appears everywhere here, as long as the sources are time dependent, this is still a function of time t and space. But when you turn off the sources, when you set nu go to zero, then by the homogeneity of the space, since we are in the liquid state, we can replace this gamma by one half of the density of particles. So this becomes simply n by 2 after turning off the sources. And turning off the sources, you regain translation invariance in the problem. And then that's when you can do the Fourier transform. So things look very messy until you do the Fourier, until you turn off the sources. And once you do that, things become very natural and easy to handle. So the next thing is basically take this product and plug it into this formula here. And really the only action is here. X, which is a pair of functional derivative operators, will act upon this piece here. Will give you one derivative here times mu plus g times the derivative of that. And this will actually split this equation into two parts exactly in a very convenient and beautiful way. So this is what you get by doing the chain rule. You get a rewriting of the previous equation where this functional derivatives act upon g inverse and mu. And those give rise to these two self energies. So phi and psi, this appears in one unholy mess. This is so far, this is nothing very simple. This is basically just rewriting of the previous equation into one big mess. And L is defined, you know, in terms of these functional derivatives and using the chain rule. But now, you can actually, you have a freedom in this whole problem. You have the freedom of declaring that this operator acting upon g gives me 1, okay? And then mu would have to equal whatever is to the right. So you can slice this exactly into two parts by making this ansatz that little g is a delta function times the inverse of this operator, and then mu has to be whatever else is to the right. But this gains you victory because little g then is a canonical Green's function. That's exactly what a canonical Green's function looks like, with some operators multiplying it, the inverse g naught, self-energy acting on g is delta function. So basically, this is how my original argument was for this product ansatz, and you see that this equation breaks into two slices, and now we can turn off the sources and things become very straightforward. So here, think of k as vector k in the Matsubara frequency. So the g inverse following from here is I omega n plus mu minus this. This is just the g naught and phi of k. That's basically this term. So this guy becomes this equation and mu becomes 1 minus n by 2 plus psi of k. Okay? And we have some rules. You have a chemical potential to determine. And this is in fact the physical number sum rule, which says that the total number of particles is n by 2. And this second sum rule is a little more subtle, and I will postpone the discussion of why this is made. But actually this, at this point, might look a little arbitrary. But if you go back and look at this definition with the Dyson-Maliev propagators, little g is going to give you the number of the unprojected electrons. And they must be the same as the projected electrons. So that has to be the same as n by 2. And originally, I had come across this by thinking of the Luttinger sum rule. Luttinger sum rule also gives you exactly the same answer. You think about getting the Fermi surface right, it also gives you this sum rule. So these two are together. They satisfy the Luttinger sum rule, the number conservation, and currently, it seems like a bit of a problem as to how do you fix two sum rules with just one Lagrange multiplier, the chemical potential. And we will find a very interesting resolution of this second chemical potential when we understand the shift identities, which I'm going to do in a few minutes.
So if you didn't have, or if you had a different
Yeah.
The second symbol on the right hand side, you would have a real problem with the location of the telecells.
Yeah.
Because a small g would generate a ghost telecells.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you could never get rid of it by this multiplicative.
Precisely. Precisely. Exactly. So that was, that's what I meant by saying the Luttinger sum rule suggested the same thing, and that's exactly what Luttinger would say. And when, I mean, at that point, I had to be a little bit brave and say, okay, I don't know where the second parameter is, because when I first wrote the first PRL on this, I didn't know anything about the shift identities. So it was kind of a, I didn't sleep very well for two nights, but then I said it has to be right, you know. But I think in, you know, when you look back at things, this is very natural and also very easy to satisfy. And I will discuss this in detail because this is an interesting point. okay, so things are exact so far. And as you asked a minute ago, where do you go from here? How do you prove, how do you use this to do anything useful? So we have to devise a small parameter, basically. And the parameter runs between 0 and 1. And in a very subtle way, this parameter also gets related to the particle density and to the double occupancy. So that at lambda equal to 0, you get the Fermi gas, and lambda equal to 1, you get the full TJ model. And we'll also require a good understanding of the shift invariance, which leads to the second chemical potential. So basically, I can give you a hint about how we do this. We can even define a set of operators and define a new Hamiltonian in which lambda appears explicitly. So you can think of the destruction operator as a good old C, the unhatted C, and the hatted creation operator can involve a lambda here. So this is at the moment just a definition, but you can actually work with this, and these lambda fermions become very interesting and respectable objects. There's a lot of promise to develop a fully Hamiltonian formalism with just these operators. And I'm not going to pursue them in these lectures because, in a way, some work remains to be done. But I'm very optimistic that we will have very powerful results here. But this tells you roughly what I'm thinking of. And in terms of the Dyson-Maliev analogy, this is again very sensible. Lambda is playing the role of the semi-classical parameter, 1 by 2s. So here, when lambda is 0, this is nothing but non-interacting fermions. And when lambda equal to 1, because of this upper triangular theorem that we saw a few minutes ago, provided we put in a suitable projection operator, this gives us the fully projected electrons. So this lambda can be exploited to do a perturbation theory. And this is carried out in the Schwinger way. And I will just sort of tell you the main points of this. So the main points are as follows. You see, if you look at how would Schwinger approach the Hubbard model, how would you approach solving the Hubbard model in the Schwinger approach? You would write a differential equation, a functional differential equation for the Hubbard model, where V would be a time-dependent potential, exactly like the potential we had here. And the Hubbard U enters this equation as a simple parameter, as a U here, okay? This is really an exact restatement of all orders of perturbation theory. And you can expand this out and, you know, work out these functional derivatives. And this generates the entire, you know, gamut of Feynman diagrams. So this is a very compact formalism we are dealing with. And so Schwinger gave us this language, which is incredibly compact. And one equation contains basically the summary of how perturbation theory arises. And the previous equation for the Green's function that I had looked like G naught inverse, Y1 and X. So Y1 is the band structure part of Y. Okay, it's basically just the hopping Tij. And lambda was exactly 1. Lambda was 1 in the previous transparency. So lambda takes its birth in this transparency. It wasn't there before, right? So I have put in by hand a parameter lambda here. And the motivation for this comes from just looking at what happens in typical models with coupling constants. So model with coupling constants, like a Hubbard model, have U. So lambda plays exactly the role of U here. But it also enters this inhomogeneous term on which this whole operator is acting. You need that because at lambda equal to 1, I need to reach the endpoint of a Fermi gas. And of course, I want to do the Fermi gas because that's where things like the Luttinger volume arise. And you know, I have some intuition for the Fermi gas. So this is basically the way in which the lambda parameter is introduced in the Schwinger equations. And it provides a continuity between the Fermi gas and the TJ model. And it also plays a role of double occupancy. This is a more subtle thing. You can actually solve these lambda equations exactly in the atomic limit. And then you see that lambda is the conjugate variable to double occupancy. And when lambda is 0, there is no double occupancy. When lambda equal to 1, you have maximal, sorry, it's the other way. When lambda equal to 1, you have 0 double occupancy. And when lambda is 0, you have maximal double occupancy. So this G naught here is, you know, this propagator with the hopping Tij. And you can do basically this product ansatz just like we did here. And the slicing of the equations happens exactly with lambda in there. So you can break this into two distinct sets of equations, one for little g and one for mu. And these involve lambda precisely as here. So we can set up a Schwinger-Dyson equation by taking successive functional derivatives of this. And we can organize, you know, the whole theory in powers of lambda, just as you would organize a theory like the Hubbard model in U. But there are some advantages, actually. I should say that I'm going to show you the terms to order lambda squared, which already contains some very interesting physics. And the comment here is lambda runs not between 0 and infinity, but between 0 and 1. So if I want to think of some rough analogy between lambda and the Hubbard U, this is something which is suggestive of the kind of thing which is happening. Lambda is bounded between 0 and 1. And 1 is reached when u goes to infinity. So this is roughly like a mapping between lambda and u. This is meant to be suggestive and not literal. This doesn't really work in detail. But it has the right endpoints and gives you some intuition for how a parameter which is bounded between 0 and 1 can have the same kind of effects as another parameter which runs between 0 and infinity. So you see, this is very compact and very powerful for that reason. If I do a perturbation theory in lambda, I don't really have to go to very high orders to try to tame large u kind of effects. Lambda is never very large. It's only as big as 1. So a low-order theory in lambda might succeed much better than a low-order theory in u would. You know. And of course, we know from the Anderson impurity model, I mean, I'm sure I have Antoine in the audience who will tell me that, in fact, in the Anderson impurity model, low order in U actually gives you very beautiful results. Almost the Yoshida-Yamada results give you a very good sense of how the renormalizations work. So low order perturbation theory is not to be sneered at in cases where you understand how the full flow happens from U to 0 to infinity. But here, it's very advantageous to have this parameter lambda with a restricted range between 0 and 1.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit lost because so at the beginning you set lambda equal to 1.
Yeah.
And this corresponds to basically killing double occupancy.
Yeah.
And so in that framework, your theorem, your single half theorem is valid, right?
Yeah.
So you can derive directly the Green function form as a product of now this G naught times.
Yes.
Now, if you now allow lambda to be between 0 and lambda, 1, you lose this property.
This is correct.
And so now I'm lost because now you make an assumption. You assume that even for lambda smaller than 1,
So, okay, so I should say that for the sake of pedagogy, I have taken a very informal approach here. Basically, I introduced this product form from the using this theorem of the single hack theorem. So that single hack theorem told us the intuition behind this product formula as the right sort of structure for the propagator. And we said that this is what we're going to expect. And then we went into the lambda, sorry, we went to the Schwinger-Dyson approach. Schwinger-Dyson approach gives me a functional differential equation to solve, and which splits into two parts on using this product ansatz. And it's at that point that I jettison the unhacked theorem. At that point, I say that, look, the hacked theorem has given me a simple way to visualize.
So you can forget about the first example.
Yeah. But indeed, I mean, your question is a very good one, because we really have to go back and see how the projection operator has to be tweaked to adjust, accommodate a lambda. So this is something that Edward and I are having a lot of fun and a lot of arguments. I don't think we've converged to any answer on that. But indeed, you've hit a very nice point. So one really, to close the circle, one has to go back and see what happens to this unhatting theorem. Is there some variety of massaging of the projection operators which can kind of get us exactly this physics? And this is, you know, terra incognita. In fact, in the boson problem, even the most outstanding papers, you know, like the Harris, Kumar, Halperin, Hohenberg paper, they had, their first approximation was throw away the projection operator. It doesn't matter. So, you know, everything which has been done with the Dyson-Maliev thing is at a very crude level. I mean, with due respect to my teachers and friends, I would still say it's very crude the way they handle the projection operator. So this is a problem which is very dear to me. I'm happy you asked this question. But okay, just to wrap up the answer, I mean, as far as we are concerned, once we understand that this product representation for the Green's function makes sense in the fully projected problem, then we sort of take the ball in the lambda expansions and run with it. We just forget about the old thing. We're just going to do the functional derivatives and see. And the functional derivatives is, you know, in a way, a completely consistent logic all by itself. And it doesn't need the Dyson-Maliev thing. Dyson-Maliev thing is a pedagogical device. And we're trying to find the middle ground between tyranny of Feynman diagrams and the tyranny of Schwinger equations, and that's where it helps us. Yeah. Yeah.
So they confuse this lambda equal to 1 is a singular point, right? The projection operator is not invertible.
This is correct.
So why should I believe in anything you say about the expansion lambda? So I don't see.
I think sitting in Paris, you should not believe in anything. I mean, this is the land of Descartes. I mean, of course, you should not believe this. And maybe I should say that the thing you should believe is the comparison with experiment. I mean, you should suspend your disbelief until I compare with experiment. And I'm going to also claim that this is like a virial expansion. And that might be, it might take some effort to convince you of that. But that's true, and I can show that. This is like virial expansion at low densities. Lambda expansion really maps to a virial expansion. But the proof is very hard and tedious, and I can't do that. And the point about inverting a singular projection operator is well taken. It's indeed, it would be fatal if I were to do something as something of that nature, and I don't do that. I don't actually.
I mean, if we just take a very vague analogy, right?
Yeah.
High temperature expansion.
Yes.
So
Yeah.
Beta particle
that's singular. Right.
And
right,
we know in that case right, that's the radius of convergence. And in fact, it doesn't invalidate the way the use of series in beta. Mm-hmm. It just means that we have to analyze how the series
converges.
Diverge on the disk of convergence.
Yeah.
And we can estimate critical exponents from that very accurately.
Yes. Well, this is a very good point. Yeah.
I mean, imagine yeah, your key and lambda equal one is a singular point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, probably not.
So I would say for in problems that I can do exactly, like the atomic limit, I can take the lambda, I can look at the exact lambda expansion to all orders in lambda. So this feature of a non-invertible projection operator is also present in the atomic limit. So there we can demonstrate explicitly that it doesn't matter. You can get push the results all the way to lambda equal to 1 and you get the exact answer. So, you know, and also, unlike the case mentioned by Antoine, in the zero temperature limit of a high temperature expansion, you have an explicitly divergent term in what you're expanding in, and you have a series of divergent terms. Here, the divergence within singularity within inverted marks is a very subtle one. The projection operator is a true projection operator at lambda equal to 1. And I haven't told you anything about how I'm going to handle the projection operator away from lambda equal to 1. So you are worried about things that I haven't talked about. And well, it's fine. It's a good thing to worry about. So I would say there are explicit examples that I can do exactly atomic limit where this kind of consideration doesn't really bother me. And Antoine is absolutely right. Even if you had a potential singularity at some point, it doesn't, you know, it's not a showstopper. What that means is you have to assess how things add up and what's the radius of convergence. That's the question you could ask.
Did you know the structure of the complex expansion?
Yeah. Yeah. Because the equation of motion can be solved exactly for any lambda. Okay, so I need to add one sort of spicy element to this whole thing, which is this watchdog theorem called shift identities. And in a way, it's a very simple thing. You know, in the Hubbard model, for example, you have a band structure Tij, and you have interaction U. And if I shift the band structure by a constant amount, namely shift the Tijs by a constant times delta ij, it clearly doesn't matter. I'm just shifting the center of gravity of the band without affecting the interactions. Now, in the TJ model, this becomes a very tricky thing because Tij is not just the propagator of electrons, it also becomes a piece of the interaction. Think of the X operators as C dagger with some N factors. Now, clearly, Tij is not just bare hopping of electrons, it also involves the interaction between particles. So if I shift Tij by some constant amount, I'm introducing some fictitious interaction into the problem. And that fictitious interaction must be pure gauge. I should be able to remove that, and it shouldn't matter to the final answer. So that's basically the essence of the shift identities. They are the analogs of pure gauge transformations. And once you realize that this invariance exists, then you can formulate a rigorous lambda expansion. And let me explain to you what I mean by this in one line here. So this is our hopping, this is the chemical potential, and this is, okay. Now if I shift Tij by a constant, arbitrary constant ut times delta ij, which is like pushing all the energy epsilons of k up or down, and similarly, I can take jij and shift them by delta ij times u of j, and these are two arbitrary parameters, then the Hamiltonian is invariant apart from a constant which is multiplied by the number operator. So this is a trivial invariance of the problem. And in particular, if I adjust ut and uj to be one quarter of each other with a minus sign, these two shifts must cancel each other even. So this tells you that I'm doing a democratic theory where the hopping and the j are being treated, you know, on with equal respect. So this is the second aspect of the shift theorem. So this is the second shift theorem, is you can adjust the shift ut by choosing appropriate uj. And perturbation theory, or whatever theory you do with the model, must respect this invariance. And this becomes a very serious problem, actually. And right. So shift theorem one is, you know, you can absorb either this or this by redefining our chemical potential, and these two shifts cancel each other with a suitable factor.
So I'm just a little bit confused. Yeah. Because the UT thing,
yeah,
is really just changing the chemical potential, right?
It is. That is a part of the first theorem, right?
So this generates.
And it's also true for this term, you see, even if you.
Oh, because of the Ni and J.
Right, I mean, SI dot SI is also.
No, SI dot SI doesn't do anything, that's why I'm
SI dot SI will also be a number operator, no?
Well, it's S squared.
S squared is fixed only the number of particles. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's trivial. It doesn't make any difference. It's completely trivial. But you know, like if you take a Slay boson theory or something, it struggles with this invariance. It fails in this test. And I was doing lots of calculations which all failed this test. You know, and then I sort of use this to positive, in a positive sense. This tells you that there is a, so this is a principle, an elementary principle. All this is elementary. But it's a principle, and you have to respect that. And it leads us to the notion of the second chemical potential. Actually, that's very useful.
Actually, I'm not sure I agree with the fact that Slay boson failed the test. I mean,
okay.
I think the saddle point, I mean, the Slay bosons are exact as a representation.
The saddle point technique fails.
So what you mean is that, and this is like the gauge transformation, what you are saying is that the saddle point peaks somehow breaks the gauge.
That's right. That's what I mean. I don't mean that the shift, I don't mean that the Slay bosons is not a correct representation. It's obviously it's exact, but any sort of Bose condensation that you do, like in the saddle point, has it freezes, and it gets into trouble with this invariance. And I think this is an interesting problem to explore. Actually, I mean, you know, so. Okay, so we have, all right, so what I want to say is I can actually proceed with this canonical analogy a little bit and write the effective Hamiltonian as a, with the fermions, and there is this interaction which is four Fermi. So this thing you see is coming from writing the X operators in terms of C dagger and C dagger, C dagger, C. So clearly the TIJ also multiplies the interactions, and you need something like a second chemical potential in order to absorb the shifts. And at the end, you can end up with almost a Feynman-esque theory, where the interaction involves, you know, is basically this is the vertex for the interaction, and it has the effects of both J and T in them, and also the U naught. So what I want to say is the shift invariance forces you to introduce a small U naught parameter, which is like a Hubbard interaction, but it's determined not by anything other than the sum rule. So you have the two sum rules, one for the physical particle number, one for the auxiliary Green's function. And this requires two Lagrange multipliers. And U naught plays a very convenient role. It's basically helps you to fix the second sum rule. And more importantly, when I write my, okay, so this is a result of a real calculation. So you do this functional differential equations, expand them out to order lambda, and to order lambda squared, you get things like this. So psi, for example, has E plus E plus E plus E plus J minus U naught G G G. And the second self-energy also looks like a bubble diagram. Basically, this looks very much like the bubble diagrams in the Hubbard model, for example. This would be U, but here it's some combination of Hopping and J. And the interesting thing to note is you get these four epsilons and a single J as a linear combination. And this has the property that this is shift invariant with respect to the second shift invariance. If I shift these epsilons by some number and J by one quarter of that number with a minus sign, they cancel each other. So this implements the second shift invariance as well. And it becomes a very powerful watchdog theorem, you see, in all these expansions. And U naught is, of course, there, sitting there to gobble up any sort of promiscuous shifts of the epsilons you do. This guy just grabs them, you know. And the thing to notice is this GGG structure is very much like second order perturbation theory of a Fermi liquid. And this gives you the insight that basically both the self energies are pretty much like Fermi liquid type self energies.
Yeah. In the way you do it,
yeah.
You've dressed up the G line.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, the Schwinger way always gives you skeleton diagram expansion.
Yeah.
So basically, this is a bold line expansion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's bad.
It's a matter of debate. I mean, I know some people don't like.
Well, okay, we can discuss this, but skeleton expansions have problems.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think the phase space arguments that we have for the Fermi liquid, that intuition comes from skeleton diagrams. So I think for certain purposes, the Bayer diagram expansion. We have actually done that as the first step in the iteration. So we have numerical solutions of these equations by spectral representations, and that is nucleated by doing a G naught thing. And we know what the answers look like, so I'm happy to share the results with you. But I think this self-consistent renormalization, like in the Dyson skeleton diagram expansion, gives you more smooth and ultimately things which are more, they look better, but you know, I don't know what that means, you see. Yeah. Okay, so why is this a perturbation theory for low densities of particles? Well, that's because each order of lambda comes with a certain number of G's, and each G basically counts the number of particles. So in fact, there's a very simple statistical counting argument which says that higher order terms in lambda would become more relevant at higher densities of particles. Okay, so this is the insight about the Fermi liquid structure. So currently we're able to do reliable numerical calculations for in the overdoped regime. And just to tell you what I mean by the overdoped regime, this is the standard dome that people talk about. And for example, the Ando resistivity in this bismuth compound in high TC, or in the lanthanum compound here, they show that you have Fermi liquid type behavior here with a curvature of the resistivity, with a curvature which is positive upwards, concave upwards. And then there is a line which is basically the line where it's linear, and then it curves the other way. So this is supposed to correspond to optimum doping. And what we are doing in this lambda expansion is avoiding this rather difficult regime, but working from the very low filling of particles and climbing our way almost up to the superconducting dome. So this is really the regime that we have done. And I think we have interesting results and rather reliable results already for density n of the order of 0.7 or 7.5 if you are very optimistic. Okay, so maybe in the last 5 minutes, and this is just to set the ground for my next talk, I want to start talking about the Arpes lines. Antoine, is that 5 more minutes is okay?
Well, I guess so. Yeah, we already got over about, so it's
Okay, just this slide, and then I will come back. Okay, so I would say, look, I mean, the ARPA's lines that we first saw that came out in the 91 paper by Olson, I think, that's really bizarre. So you saw spectral lines which look sort of very broad, you know, and there is this marked asymmetry. They basically hang out to the left and don't seem to die off sufficiently rapidly. And this compares with, you know, what you expect for Fermi liquids, much more symmetrical, much more Lorentzian type things. So this is the surprise in the high TC world. And I'm going to talk about how things have improved experimentally and theoretically as well. There is the better shapes, and there are better, okay, let's just say that we have, I'll show you one picture and then we'll stop. So today, you know, 30 years on or whatever, the data has become much more clean. You actually see really beautiful ARPA's lines experimentally, and these red lines are from the theoretical calculations that I've just outlined. This actually fits stuff to incredible accuracies. And there are predictions, there are some details about these line shapes, which I think are very significant. So I'd like to reserve time for them for the next lecture, and we will go over how we arrive at some of these pictures and how we, and what lessons we learn from this. So maybe this is a good time for me to close my talk, and for a few minutes, if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer the questions.